Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, February 21st, 2010, and this is show number 246. Well, we have a big show today. We've got three product reviews from Macworld, one from me, one from Steve, and one from Elliot. We have the gruesome tale of my Aperture 3 upgrade, my journey to drop iTunes for video playback and use Miro instead, and in chit-chat across the pond, we talk about HTML5, and we find out that my miserable Aperture 3 upgrade was a sugarcane dream compared to Bart's experience. Well, we better get started if we're going to fit all of that in. So I promised you last week that I would give you some actual content about Macworld. Last week was all about people, which was the best part, but we should talk about some actual products, I think. The first product I'd like to talk about is called Budsock, and I actually heard about it at lunch from a friend of Gene McDonald's from smileonmymac.com. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. You know the rules. We have to start with a problem to be solved. I've been using an iPod Nano for a long time. I had the first and second generation Nanos, and they had the wonderful advantage of fitting the Apple-branded lanyard headphones. These delightful lanyard headphones hung around your neck and gave you only a 6-inch long headphone hanging off of them, so they couldn't really get tangled. Okay, they could get a tiny bit tangled, but not that bad because the headphone part was pretty short. I didn't upgrade to a new Nano for years because for some inexplicable reason, Apple stopped making the lanyard headphones after the Gen 2 Nanos. The headphones cost a fortune. They're like $39 a piece. And I went through three pair because I actually would break them. But, you know, look at it this way. Look at all the money I saved on upgrading my iPod. Well, finally, my last Gen 2 Nano died, and I decided it was time to move on. But that's when the misery started. iPhone headphones tangle like nothing I have ever seen before. I can lay them down in a straight line on a block of granite with no wind blowing, turn in one circle, and they'll be tangled. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? You've had this problem. God forbid you put them in your purse or your pocket or something. You're doomed. It takes you like 12 minutes to start playing with your headphones. All right, enough suspense. What is the solution? Enter Budsock from budsock.com. Budsock is this triangular little piece of organic cotton that it's sort of like a pocket for your headphones. You slide the headphone cable into the Budsock and you pull it until the headphones are captive inside. And then you place the headphone jack into it, and two little snaps inside actually hold this thing captive. The end condition is that both the headphones and the jack are captive, and the cable's in a circle now, so it cannot get tangled with itself. It's a very simple solution, and the Budsock is very, very light, so you hardly notice that it's hanging off your cable during normal use. I suppose you could pull it off, but I just leave it hanging there. I put a picture in the show notes so you can see what this looks like. It seems a bit odd, but I've been using it for about a week, and I find it to be perfectly usable. In that week of use, my headphone cables have not gotten tangled one single time, and I used to swear at my headphones hourly before I got my Budsock. You can buy the Budsock for the grand total price of $4, and if you buy it in large quantities, and I mean large, you can get it branded for your own product. And as the creator described it to me, you can then give them away as chotsky at conferences. I think it's a cool little solution to a problem we all have. Check out the Budsock at budsock.com. Well, last week when I talked about the great fun we had at the NoSilla Castaways party, I explained that I was sure I would be forgetting some people. Now, it turns out, technically, I did not forget anyone from the party, but some people didn't make it to the party, so I did neglect to mention them. I went through the photos. I cheated to remember who everybody was. Well, anyway, outside of the party, I had the great joy of finally meeting Elliot from Elliot Media Group. Elliot has been a good friend of the show over the years, and it was really fun to find him in line for one of the keynotes. We didn't get to talk too much, but since I get to see his great YouTube videos so often, I feel like I know him already. Actually, you should go check out Elliot Media Group on YouTube. I put a link in the show notes because he's just about to hit 300,000 views on his videos. So go over and throw him a couple of more hits so he can hit 300,000. That'll be a lot of fun. Well, anyway, let's see. I also ran into Robin and Alice Saunders, also known as Miniology and LWR32, and Mark Shepard, also known as Mark Shepard on Twitter. They were having a ball, but somehow had lost Jenny Sutherland, who I'd really hoped to meet, but it was not meant to be. She was the only person I thought I would meet at the show, and I didn't get to meet. Oh, well, Robin and Alice and Mark were delightful, and they looked like kids in a candy shop when I saw them right outside the show floor. They were having a great time. They were gracious enough to pose for a picture or two with me, and so did Elliot. So they're now in my second Flickr photo set about Macworld. Of course, there's a link in the show notes to that. Ooh, and I almost forgot. Gazmaz made a showing at Macworld, too. Bet you didn't know that. Take a look at that Flickr set to find him. Back by popular demand, I have Steve Sheridan here to do another one of his fabulous reviews. How you doing, Steve?
I'm doing fine, Al. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. Well, tell us what you're going to review today.
I'm going to review the iFrogs CS40 headphones, part of their Ear Pollution Comfort series.
Ooh, sounds nice. So that's part of the video you did, right?
Right.
So Steve did took a video of me doing an interview with a guy at Macworld Expo, and it's up online at on YouTube, and there's going to be an embedded link in the show notes so you can watch the video. But so tell us some more here.
Yes. These are the headphones that you you saw at Macworld. Jeff Morgan from iFrogs showed those to you, offered you a review pair. I thought I'd try them out, but you had the caveat that I had to give you a review before I could have them. So I'm taking you up on that offer.
I didn't say it had to be a good review. I just said do a review. So what do you think?
Pretty good. Let me just say a little bit about the headphones. These are an on-the-ear versus an over-the-ear design. The pair I tried was an electric blue color with a toxic symbol on each earpiece.
I always like that on my headphones.
I believe that was a reference to the Ear Pollution moniker, so they look pretty cool. They have a 4-foot rubberized cord, not one of the plastic, but more of a rubberized cord, standard 3.5-millimeter mini plug connector, and they weigh 5.8 ounces.
That's pretty light, right?
Pretty light as headphones go. I'd say in the low to mid range. They list for $40, but you can find them on Amazon for around $23. So they're at the low end of the cost category for headphones. Pretty inexpensive.
Okay, so we shouldn't be expecting Bose quality sound out of these then.
No, it wouldn't be fair. Wouldn't be prudent. Parameters for this review, a couple of them. First, the type of music I listen to.
Music?
Yeah, I know that's one of those strange concepts to you, but I do listen to it once in a while. And then the other headphones I was comparing against the iFrogs. So why do I talk about the music, the type of music? I think the choice of music is important since one pair of headphones can sound better or worse than another depending on the type of music you're listening to. So to put this in perspective, I used Listen to the Music by the Doobie Brothers. I think this song has a good combination of crisp highs, lots of mid-range vocals, and it has a good bass line, which I always appreciate.
You love that bass, don't you?
So the range of tones gives the headphones a good workout. And it was also one of my favorite songs as a teenager.
You 80s man, you.
Yes.
I won't call you Disco Boy.
Please.
You had to bring There's a whole story about that.
We won't go into that. Now, the headphones that I compared against the iFrog were the Sennheiser HD 212 Pros. They list for $52, so a bit more expensive than the iFrogs.
Almost double. More than double.
Yeah. And then the Sony MDR NC6, which are noise cancellation headphones for $74. Even though these are noise cancellation, I turned off that feature so we had more of an apples-to-apples comparison. But they clearly are in a higher cost category.
So we've got one double, one triple, but those are the lowest end headphones we have other than maybe Apple earbuds to compare
right.
to.
Right, and I didn't feel that was quite fair. So admittedly, both the Sonys and the Sennheisers are higher, but I think they're higher in cost, but generally in the same category, not quite at the Bose.
Okay.
In terms of how did the iFrogs feel, reasonably comfortable headphones with really spongy earpieces. Although the head strap is fairly broad at about 1 inch to help distribute the load across the head, it's made of hard plastic and, in my view, could get annoying over long listening periods.
Now, this is an interesting point. I tried them on, and I thought, wow, these feel fantastic. And Steve noticed this strap on the top. Now, Steve and I argue a little bit. I don't want to say on the air that I think he's a pinhead or anything like that.
All right, and we could say things about your head, but we'll refrain.
You could call me a fat head, but it is actually important to realize a different size head is going to have a different experience. Because I didn't notice this head strap at all. So
and I did.
Your mileage may vary.
Yeah, if you have a fat head, I think you'll like these headphones. So I think they could improve a little on the comfort if they just put a little padding in the head strap.
Okay.
How do they sound? I will say right up front, I'm pretty picky with sound quality, and there's room, a lot of room for improvement in this area. The sound separation could be better. The sound was pretty muddy and not as responsive as the Sennheisers or the Sonys.
Now, I'll have to agree with you on that. I just, of course, I didn't listen to music with them. That would be silly. I listened to a podcast, and it did sound muddy. It sounded kind of mushy.
Yeah.
Again, $22.
Right. And maybe you pay for what you get for.
Right.
Or you get what you pay for. The bass response was not very good at the low end, and I'm particular about bass. The cymbals and the tambourine at the high end didn't pop as well. It wasn't mm-hmm. quite as crisp. But I was really surprised that the mid-range vocals got lost in the sound of the instruments. And usually, mm-hmm. even with mid to low-end high headphones, the vocals come through. So I was a little surprised at that.
So not great on the sound. Now, one other thing I wanted to say on the comfort side, you didn't compare that on the Sennheisers and the Sonys?
No, I didn't. I would say my preference was for the Sennheisers. To me, they are the most comfortable of those three.
And I can't stand the Sennheisers. In yeah. fact, I gave you the Sennheisers, and you got me some Bose headphones for podcasting, and I don't care what they sound like at all. I got them because they felt good, because they were so comfortable.
Yeah.
So I would pick the iFrogs 10 to 1 over the Sennheisers. And again, we think that has to do with the size of your head, because my on the Sennheisers, it just feels like it's mashing my head, and yet felt very comfortable to you. Yeah. But the Sennheisers have that padding in the top part.
And the Sennheisers are much more springy, a little tighter fitting, and with my, we'll say, more narrow head, it's probably more natural than the looser iFrogs. So I could see how we might have a difference of opinion there.
Okay, so bottom line it for us.
Bottom line, if you're going for the cool looks at a low price, then the iFrog CS40s are for you. That'd be an excellent selection. With me, a little more particular with the sound quality, these are not the headphones for me, and I would opt for a different pair and probably spend a little more money just to get that sound quality.
All right. Well, thanks for the review, Steve. I'm sure that's going to be helpful to people of the small head size.
My pleasure.
All right. We'll talk to you later. While we were at Macworld Expo, Apple released Aperture 3. Now, a normal person would wait until they got home to buy a product of this magnitude and take their time doing an upgrade and do it right. But that sure doesn't sound like me now, does it? No, of course not. Steve and I ran over to the Apple store while we were in San Francisco. Okay, we went over there a couple times. Anyway, and I installed it immediately. It failed. It told me I didn't have enough disk space. I had 50 gigabytes free, but that wasn't enough. But it said I didn't have enough disk space to upgrade my library from Aperture 2 to Aperture 3. Apparently, it has to take your entire library, make a copy of it, do the upgrade, and then copy it back. All right, well, I did have an 80 gigabyte library, so I guess that makes sense. All right, no worries, though. Steve had an external 500 gigabyte drive with him that he uses to offload video. So I stole it from him, and I moved my library over there. That took all night. Then I ran the upgrade to the library, and it went off without a hitch. It was beautiful. Woke up in the morning, and there was the new library. Cool. I opened it from the external hard drive, and it looked great. So then I had to delete the Aperture 2 library from my internal disk to make room for the upgraded library. No big deal. Finally, or so I thought finally, I now had to drag the new library back to the internal disk. I started that the next evening, and I went to sleep. When I woke up in the morning, the copy had failed. I got an error message, and I looked up the error message, and it wasn't an Aperture error message. It was actually a Finder error, because now I'm not even in Aperture. I'm just dragging the folder over. But it turns out the external portable drive I was using was formatted FAT32. Now, that's a format that a lot of drives come in. It makes it compatible for reading and writing from Windows and Mac, but it's a very, 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 very old format. And it has some limitations. For example, one of the limitations is the size of an individual file, I think, has to be around 4 gig. I'll keep an eye on the chat room to see if they're telling me I said that wrong, but I think it's 4 gig. The other limitation is you can't have file names longer than 32 characters. Well, that's not a big deal. But it turns out that character limit also includes the path name, so all the folder structure you've got it in. So it turns out there's some little bug in Snow Leopard 10.6.2 that causes problems moving lots of embedded folders, and it's been related back to FAT32. I found some people who had success by actually downgrading their operating system to 10.6.1 and then doing the copy and then moving back up to 10.6.2. But I wasn't willing to do that, and certainly not on the road. Well, the good news is I actually do backups. I have a backup at home, and I have an offsite backup at work, and I had done them right before I left on the trip. So that's one of the reasons I wasn't too nervous about just doing some sort of, jumping around, doing crazy stuff on my trip. So I knew there was no need to panic. But I didn't get to do Aperture while I was gone, and I couldn't use my Aperture library at all because Steve needed his hard drive. Luckily, Bart explained to me that I could create a new Aperture library on my internal drive, and then I could merge them when I get back, which does end up working later in this plot. Well, when I got home, I plugged in my FireWire drive, which is formatted Mac OS X extended, not FAT32. I ran the update against that library, and of course, it went off without a hitch. Overnight, I copied it back to my hard drive. I slept like a baby because I knew there couldn't possibly be any more problems. But when I woke up and checked, the library on my internal drive was only 1.3 gigabytes. In the words of Scooby-Doo, rut-row, this was not good. For some reason, I thought, I'll just try opening the library. Maybe it'll just work somehow. Well, I put a picture in the show notes of what it looked like, but basically every image representing an event in Aperture looked like an old test pattern on TV after the shows went off the air. Not exactly what one was hoping for first thing in the morning. All right, I now only had one more copy of the data, so I was starting to sweat bullets. I've got the Aperture 3 version on the external drive at home, and I still have an Aperture 2 library at work. Before I ever touch that one, I'm going to copy that Aperture 2 library, so I have two more. But I started thinking about it, and I thought, what can I do? What can I do differently? And I came up with a brilliant idea. I didn't do anything differently at all. I just tried copying it again. This time, though, I watched the little booger to make sure it behaved. I have to say I really appreciated that Connor was in a chat with me the whole time, virtually holding my hand and holding his breath with me as it got near the end. For some reason, this particular voodoo actually worked. It did hang for a long time, right around 1.3 gigabytes, right where it failed before, but for some reason, it churned past it finally, and it gave me the entire library back, all safe and sound. So I was up, everything was fine. At that point, I realized I actually hadn't noticed the functionality of Aperture 3 with all the problems I had just getting the darn library to work. Well, let's start with the bad news. Aperture 3 has lots of problems. You can go online and read more, but at the very least, Aperture has memory issues. Now, I'm not skilled at diagnosing all this stuff, but I noticed Aperture running really slowly, and I noticed all my memory was used up. Evidently, that's what they call a memory leak. A memory leak is when an application keeps taking more and more memory and won't give it back, so eventually you run out of RAM, which is, RAM is really fast memory. Well, when your machine runs out of RAM, it has to keep going, so rather than just die, it starts using a hard disk instead. That sounds like a great solution, but the hard drive's really slow compared to RAM. It's better than running out, but it's a real drag when you want to just brighten a photo and this spinning pizza wheel of death is your entertainment. I'm expecting, hoping, we'd better see an update fairly quickly for this problem. It's way too pervasive for them to ignore. I've had troubles quitting. It just hangs, crashes on quit. I can't quit. I end up having to force quit. Talked to a couple people who've had the same problem, but I've also talked to people who go, I don't know what you're whining about. Works great for me. All right, let's talk about a little bit of good stuff. Aperture has always been the professional program, snooty professional program, if you will, while iPhoto was the fun program. Using Aperture was like being in the vegetable juice aisle while there's a party going on over in the ice cream aisle. iPhoto had faces and places and all that kind of fun stuff, and we had to convince ourselves that our superior photo editing tools were enough to keep us entertained. But secretly, or not so secretly in Bart's case, we were jealous of iPhoto. Well, Aperture 3 brings faces and places to the snootier professional people. Aperture 3 also has events, just like iPhoto, so your photos are automatically categorized as well. I haven't played with it too much, but I think it might be a cool feature. I did turn on faces, and boy, you want to make your machine come to a crawl? Turn on faces. I talked to somebody who kept faces running all night, and oh, it takes forever. So I think that's another reason people are having slowdowns, and maybe that was my problem too. Maybe I didn't have the memory leak problem, but I'm not sure. Anyway, what actually excites me the most is I was excited that Aperture 3 comes with three lovely eye candy buttons to share photos with MobileMe, Flickr, and Facebook. Now, you could always do that before, but you had to use these dodgy plugins that worked nearly 60% of the time. I tested the Flickr button, and it was really fast at uploading web-size versions, which means it was making the conversion and size for me and then doing the upload. I found I posted a lot more pictures right away, though, because it was so fast. There is a problem, though, is you can't select from an existing photo set and put them into that photo set. So I put up like 10 pictures to Macworld Expo, and then I said, okay, I'm going to put up another 10, and it created another photo set called Macworld Expo 1. Put up another set of 10, it was Macworld Expo 20 or something like that. So it was, it's really annoying. And even if you name it the same thing in the little window, it doesn't put it in the same place. So that's really irritating. I may have to go back to the dodgy plugin. Well, another thing I am excited about is that Aperture 3 will import movies. In Aperture 2, it simply wouldn't recognize them. I'd much rather have them managed by Aperture, but in the past, what I've had to do is copy them into random folders over an iPhoto. So that's kind of problematic. I got my videos in one and my photos in the other. Now I can have a movie I made on my iPod Nano of the Cirque du Mac party right in line with the rest of my Macworld photos. The interface has changed a bit here and there in Aperture 3, and I have not gotten all the way through or even partway through knowing what's different. But so far, other than the memory leak problem, I haven't found anything that didn't make it easier to use. I did find some things that were easier. Bottom line, wait until Apple fixes the memory leak and all the other problems, but then go for it when they ship that. We'll let you know for sure. Aperture 3 is $200 from Apple or $100 as an upgrade from Aperture 2. Well, this week's Screen Steps ad is actually courtesy of a real user. Let's listen in.
Hi, Alison. It's Stu here from the International Mac Podcast, found over at ironpodcast.tv. And the latest team member over at Agile Web Solutions, along with the lovely Geeta. Yes, you can find us at agile.ws. There you go. Geeta, extra pay this month. Anyway, yeah, I thought you'd like to hear that Screen Steps, the fantastic product from Blue Mango Software, which lets you create, well, you know what it does, Alison, lets you create fantastic lessons, just taking screenshots, making notes. It's fantastic. Anyway, I'm using that at Agile because there's times where I'll need to show a customer something specific and, you know, maybe I don't have the time to necessarily record a screencast or it's not on our blog. I'll just do a quick Screen Steps thingy for them and send it over in the support email. So that's how I use Screen Steps at Agile. Love you, Alison. Bye.
Well, thanks, Stu. I'm so glad Screen Steps helps you in your new job. And again, congratulations on getting to work with the lovely Geeta. Well, for the rest of you, if you'd like to be able to create valuable instructional documentation like Stu with such ease that it's actually fun to do, you really should check out Screen Steps over at screensteps.com. And don't forget to use my coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name, all capital letters spelled backwards, for 25% off the purchase price over at screensteps.com.
Hi, Alison. It's Elliot here from ElliotMediaGroup.com. First of all, I wanted to say how much I enjoyed meeting with you briefly at Macworld. And even though you didn't mention me in your podcast last week, I'm sure we can still be cordial towards one another. Now to the main point of my recording. I wanted to review for you and your listeners a product I picked up at Macworld. And in true NoSilicast style, I will start out with a problem to be overcome. Have you ever lost or forgotten the cable that connects your camera to your computer to download pictures? Or have you ever wanted to post pictures that you take out and about in almost real time to one of those numerous photo sharing sites? Well, the iFi Share Video 4GB SD card aims to solve that. But how does it accomplish this monumentous feat? The card, which looks perfectly normal on the outside, is quite the contrary on the inside. Enclosed in the device is a wireless transmitter that is capable of connecting to a predetermined Wi-Fi network. Once set up with the included web-based software, the card can be inserted into your camera and you can snap away. Your pictures will be beamed to the photo-sharing sites of your choice, wherever your computer is on or off, including Flickr, Evernote, Facebook, Photoshop.com, Shutterfly, SmugMug, Costco, TypePad, Snapfish, PhotoBucket, Walmart, or even an FTP server, just to name a few. The device can also transmit pictures to a local folder or to iPhoto next time you turn on your computer. The system works like magic, and the interface for setting everything up is very slick. For initial setup or to make changes to Wi-Fi networks, the card does have to be physically connected to a computer with the included SD card reader, which is also a very nice freebie. I've managed to test the device out in two different scenarios. The first was within 20 minutes of buying the device at the expo while sitting at John Gruber's presentation. I managed to connect the device to the free, albeit wimpy, Wi-Fi at the expo, and after a little trial and error, it worked like a charm. Photos were beamed to Flickr without my computer even being turned on. It was a surreal and almost creepy experience to see my pictures online within 30 seconds of taking them. The second scenario I tested the device in was when I got back home. I connected the device to my WPA encrypted wireless network, and it worked just as before. There was a little trouble setting it up, but I believe this was due to the weirdo setup I have at home using an Airport Express and a time capsule on my network. Resetting the routers seemed to do the trick, and I was happily snapping away at various household items just to see the magic of wireless downloading. Results at home were much faster as well, almost instantaneous in fact, and my suspicion for this is that I am not sharing one hotspot at home with 4,000 other people, like at the expo. I was unable to test the ability to upload videos on the device due to the fact that my Nikon D60 doesn't shoot video. It says it does on the box, and I'm inclined to trust the company that it does what it says, as everything else that's been said on the box works like a charm. There's only one downside to the device that I was able to find. Seeing as I have jailbroken my iPhone, and now that it sports the wonderful MyWi application, which, by the way, might be a wonderful topic for another review in the future, I was hoping I could connect my Wi-Fi to the MyWi network to upload pictures on the go. This, in fact, is not the case due to the fact that the card I bought doesn't support ad hoc networking. I see on iFi's website that ad hoc support is coming soon in a higher-priced card, so I might be lucky that a firmware update might trickle down and enable this feature. I do know for sure that the iFi card works with the Verizon MyFi router, so that might be another option should you desire to upload pictures anytime, anywhere. All in all, I am very satisfied with the product. I paid $59.99 for it at the expo, but it retails for around $80 on their website. There are also cheaper and more expensive versions of the device that remove or add features, respectively. The device is very cool, and I'm sure I'll be using it in the future. If you would like to find out more about me, visit elliottmediagroup.com or follow me on Twitter. My username is ElliotMB. Thanks for all the work you do, Allison. Now back to the show.
Elliot, I am so glad you picked this particular device to review. I went by that booth and I spent like 15 minutes with this guy, and I even did an interview with him. And when I was done, I was completely befuddled on how this darn thing actually works. He did explain a few things I was confused about, but he took a turn somewhere and completely lost him. I was trying to figure out whether to play this awful interview, but now I was able to throw it away because I didn't have to because I had yours. I really appreciate that. One last thing about Macworld, for this week anyway, is the Mac Roundtable was live on stage, on the main stage in the middle of the exhibit hall, and we did a live show. I think I talked about last week. There were like 10 of us on stage. It was awesome. Katie and David and Don, and we even had Mac OS Ken. He was on there for the first time. He's technically always been a member, but that's the first time we got him actually to talk with us. And of course, Victor and, everybody, Adam and, what's that guy's name? That guy I keep having dreams about? I can't remember his name. Anyway, Dave Hamilton and John F. Braun. I mean, it was a huge crowd. Tim Verporten. We had just gotten Tim in for the first time in real life, so that was really fun. But anyway, I talked about that before, but the video is up now at macroundtable.com. You got to go see it because it's so much fun to get to see the faces with the voices for the first time. A lot of those people, we've never had voices and faces together, so it was really, really fun, and you definitely need to check it out. Well, I'm not sure when it started happening, but a while back, iTunes just kind of went into the crapper for me. One day I'd click on a video podcast to play, and I'd get a spinning beach ball of death. As Bart would say, "What?" Well, then it started to stutter on videos when it did get around to bringing them up. My favorite part, though, is that if I watch a video podcast on my external monitor, and then I unplug the monitor with it still open on that secondary monitor, and I go someplace else, and now I don't have the secondary monitor hooked up, iTunes thinks it's still there. So that means I simply cannot watch videos in iTunes again until I hook up the monitor, open up iTunes, drag that monitor, that window back over. I mean, quitting it doesn't fix it. Let's see, it's been suggested I try to use the gather windows option in the display's preferences, but that option is only available if you have a second monitor connected. You can't do it. So clearly, at this point, OS X knows there isn't a monitor there, so why doesn't iTunes realize that? Well, I've been fighting with this like 6 months. It's just been irritating the daylights out of me for forever, so I'm tired of it. Basically, playing video on iTunes is a constant source of distress. So this week, I decided I actually have a great alternative. I switched all of my video podcasts over to Miro from getmiro.com. Now, I've talked about Miro about a half dozen times in the show before, dating back to when it was called Democracy Player back in, I don't know, pre-2007. I'm not sure why I didn't think of using this sooner for my video playback, because Miro is a beautiful video player with an intuitive interface. I'm not going to do a full review because I have talked about it before, but I want to give you a few tips if you decide to follow my lead. Subscribing is a teeny bit harder than it is for iTunes because you can't go through the iTunes store. However, most websites have little RSS links or just text that'll say subscribe to the podcast. Right-click on any one of those and select copy. It depends on which browser you're using, what words come after the word copy. Sometimes it's copy shortcut, just copy, whatever. Just copy it. Anyway, then in Miro, select from the sidebar from the menu and pull down to New Feed, or just click Command N. A window pops up that already has the feed URL pasted in, so your only work here is to tell Miro whether you want the feed under video or audio. Now, if the podcaster is super hip like me, they do have their podcast in the Miro guide, which is right inside the Miro player, just like iTunes is inside iTunes, just like the iTunes store is inside iTunes, I should say. So if you click on the Miro guide, you can look them up in there. And you, if you're really super double secret hip like me, you have a giant Miro badge on your website. So if all you have to do to select to my audio podcast is to click that Miro badge on my website. Anyway, it's actually pretty much as easy as iTunes now that I think about it, as long as they have gotten themselves registered inside the Miro guide. There's only one thing I don't like about Miro for podcasts. It's slightly harder to get rid of episodes you don't want to download. For example, if you subscribe to my feed, you get a little box for all 246 episodes. You can't shift, select, and delete them. If you do that, you delete the entire feed. The only thing I figured out is that you can't click the little pull-down thingy that says full feed, and that kind of folds them up out of the way so you don't have to look at them. And then you'll get a pull-down thingy for just the downloaded episodes. That cleans things up, but it still bugs me that I can't figure out how to delete them. I tried right-clicking, and I tried all kinds of stuff. Couldn't get rid of them. Other than that, though, I am loving Miro. Most importantly, Miro does not take a full minute to launch my videos. They start right away. Secondly, they don't stutter when they start. They look perfect now. As a side benefit, the links that are in the descriptions are actually clickable, unlike iTunes. Way cool. Another thing that blows my dress up is I can play a movie in full screen on one monitor and actually do some work on the other monitor. That makes my external 24-inch display like having a TV right there, and I can still read email or work on the podcast on my laptop monitor. Very, very nice. Oh, and guess what else? When I unplug that external monitor, Miro knows it's not there. Anyway, I'm pretty excited about this solution. I have a feeling I won't be going back to iTunes for video anytime soon, especially since I don't really watch video podcasts on my iPhone or iPod Nano, so syncing over to iTunes doesn't matter at all to me. Anyway, check out Miro at getmiro.com. How do you feel about your car? Do you love it? Do you hate it? Do you tolerate it? No matter how you feel about your car, you want one thing from it. You want it to get you from point A to point B without fear that it will leave you stranded anywhere. You want to turn that key and have the ignition just start. Whether you buy a new car every year or milk every mile out of your vehicles, there's only one way to ensure that reliability, and that's having regular maintenance done on your car. If you have a Honda or an Acura, you know they're really, really reliable, but it's still essential that you get those fluids changed, belts checked, all that kind of nonsense. But it's easy to procrastinate on this kind of thing because it's such a hassle. You know, if something's broken, you'll take it in, but that preventative maintenance, it's really hard to get around to. But if you live in the LA or Orange County area, you can just have Honda Bob come over to your house at any time convenient to you. He'll get all dirty digging around in your engine while you sip a cup of tea in your house reading a nice novel. If this sounds good to you, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or shoot him an email over at hjbob@aol.com. H.A. Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, Honda Worldwide. Well, it's my favorite time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. How are you on this 20th of November, of February?
November already? Wow, that year went quick.
I'm not good at
I'm
this.
I'm good.
You know, we kid around Stormwatch 2010. Last night, they're like, thunderstorms, it rained, it's going to be, you know, torrential downpour. We woke up, the sun is shining, the sky is blue, and we ran on the beach. It's like 50 degrees out, you know.
Oh, yes, we could do it more storms like that. Can we have a few of those storms?
Exactly. It's rough here. It's terrible. It's rough.
Yeah.
So what do we have on the docket today? We got some security light going on?
We do, but just before we dive into it, we're sort of a... Well, I'm Belgian, and we have a lot of Belgian listeners, so I just wanted to just take a moment. I don't actually know if this made news outside of Europe. Did you hear at all about the rail disaster in near Brussels?
Yeah, actually, it was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm surprised by that, but it was a big deal, yeah.
So tell people what happened?
Well, we had an intercity express train, which had luckily just left a station, which encountered head-on a local train.
Head-on?
Yeah, it was actually slightly sideways head-on because one train was crossing over the other train's track. And so although they collided face-on, they were crossing rather than heading straight into each other.
Wow. And quite a few people died from this, right?
The death toll has now stabilized at 18.
Wow.
To be honest, for a long time, everyone thought it would be a lot more because when you saw aerial views of the scene, it was carnage. It was really quite disturbing. I was in work when the news started trickling through and everyone came into my office going, there's none of your family. I was like, well, I don't know if there's any of my family involved, but geographically speaking, I don't think any of my family live there or would have any reason to travel there by train. And it was a morning commuter service. So I guess probably the biggest lucky thing was that it was a midterm break. So all the children were off school.
Oh, wow.
Because otherwise that train would have been full of school kids.
Well, with our high Belgian percentage here on the show, we wanted to bring this up. Just our hearts go out to the families and people involved.
Yeah, I just wanted to give condolences to anyone who was affected by this. And hopefully our listeners have escaped involvement. But there were something like 170-odd people injured. So, you know, yeah, it's a lot of people.
And there were some not good injuries in that list, as I recall.
Yes, some of the reporting did not make for pleasant reading.
Yeah. Well, on a lighter note.
On a lighter note, our friends in Adobe.
What's going on in this week in Adobe Hacks?
Actually, there's no actual new Adobe Hacks, but what did catch my eye that I thought I'd bring up under this topic, because I couldn't think of any other way to bring it up, is a report from a security firm who say that of all the stuff they dealt with throughout 2009, 80% of all exploits they dealt with were caused by malicious PDFs targeting Adobe's Acrobat Reader.
Now, I heard about that too. I heard about it on Buzz Out Loud, and they asked whether if you were using Apple's Preview or, say, Foxit Reader, the open source PDF reader, would you be affected? And I think the exploits that were used in it would have only affected Adobe. Not that the others couldn't have exploits, but...
Well, yes, the others are exploitable, but they would have to target the attacks at their particular brand of crappiness.
That's the security by obscurity. If you were using a lesser used reader, you'd have been okay.
You'd have been more okay for sure. Ultimately, it comes down to the fact that the PDF spec is overly complicated, and so complicated no one can make head nor tail of it. So it's exceptionally difficult to write code without bugs when the spec is so complicated. I listen to some security podcasts, and there's a running joke that my refrigerator is probably valid to the PDF spec. Because it's just so broad and so sweeping that goodness knows what could be covered under that PDF spec, and no one can disprove that my refrigerator is not valid PDF.
Okay, that's good.
So 80%, which I guess from Adobe's point of view, the really bad news here is that this shift, the 80%, has not. It's not that those weren't already Adobe problems. It's that Flash attacks have shifted to PDF attacks. So these were people exploiting Adobe, and now they're exploiting Adobe. So from every point of view, Adobe is just not doing well at all. The two biggest attack vectors these days are both of their products.
Yikes. So is there anything we can do about this? Don't use Adobe?
Well, this actually leads to a giant problem. Everyone has been told, for the sake of openness, to use PDFs. I do it. I tell people to use PDF.
Sure.
Because I don't want them sending me Word documents. I don't really think it's appropriate to send people JPEGs of your documents. Right. It's not going to work for a 400-page report. So what does that leave us with? Plain text? Yeah, I don't think so. RTF? I guess maybe, but RTF and graphics? How does that really all work out?
Right. So you pretty much have to use PDF.
So you kind of have to use PDF. So your only real choice is to be one of the people not using the Adobe suite, because the Adobe suite is what's being targeted. Now, this report contains two graphs that are jaw-dropping and really explain why everyone's targeting the Adobe products. So one of them is the list of Acrobat users. The list of all machines and their Acrobat-iness. So 9.5% of computers that is looked after by this firm don't have Acrobat at all. 7% have an up-to-date copy of Acrobat. And 83.3% have an out-of-date version of Acrobat. In other words, a vulnerable version of Acrobat. So be in the 7%, not in the 83%, if you do have to use Adobe's products.
You know, I have great sympathy for these companies, though, because, you know, if the only product you had to keep your eye on was anything made by Adobe, it's quite easy to, you know, write scripts and keep an eye on the latest updates and push them out and all that sort of thing. But actually, negotiating with Adobe for rights to push out updates is very problematic. Adobe doesn't like that. Yep. They want everyone to go to the website. So you do have an 83% chance you're going to be out of date. I mean, I don't see how you can avoid that.
We have licensing issues with Adobe on campus as well.
Yeah.
Their licenses are exceptionally difficult for IT to do the right thing.
Yeah.
They really don't make it easy.
So they make it more likely to be exploited, right?
Yeah. And the other interesting graph is that it seems to be that the reason people have switched from attacking Flash to Acrobat is that now only 80% of computers have an out-of-date version of Flash, 1% have no Flash, and 19% of people update their Flash.
That's the good news.
The issue here is don't be in that giant big red slice on these pie charts that has out-of-date Adobe software.
Yeah.
Try not to have any, would be my personal advice, but definitely, definitely, definitely update it.
And so as an end user, what we ought to be doing is using things like Foxit Reader and Preview.
Yeah, and keep your Flash up to date, because unfortunately you can't avoid Flash. And things like Flash Block, where you minimize your exposure to Flash, are also very good things to do.
Great. All right, well, we don't want to spend the whole time on Adobe.
No, let's bash someone else. Someone we've never bashed before.
Who's that?
OpenOffice.
Oh, come on. How could an open source application be problematic?
Well, okay, this is one of those cases of they've patched some flaws that haven't actually been exploited by anyone.
Oh?
But they've closed the door now. So no, now that they're known, this is always the big thing. Before anyone knows the problem's there, they're not attacked very much, and OpenOffice isn't a big target. But now that the flaws are known, and it's an open source product, so they can simply have a look at the code of the last version and the code of this version and say, what's changed? Oh, look, that's where the problem is. So now the effort involved is almost nil to attack OpenOffice out-of-date versions. The gain is going to be low, but it's, you know, gain versus effort. Low gain, low effort, still a reasonable attack.
Right.
Low gain, high effort, sorry, not on. So I would still update if I was using OpenOffice.
All right.
Or get iWork.
Which will just be exploited differently.
Which will just be exploited differently, yeah. Because Apple's record isn't super.
Right. OpenOffice is doing it before it's exploited, where Apple likes to wait, you know, 6-8 months to do it afterwards, right?
And then brag about how great their security is.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, this, I mean, in fairness, OpenOffice are doing exactly the right thing. And to say we're hitting on OpenOffice isn't actually remotely fair. They found problems, they fixed problems, they released an update. That's what people should. Then, on a similar vein of found problems, released update, we have Mozilla, who have pushed out a security update to Firefox, Thunderbird, and SeaMonkey. So if you're running Firefox, you should be on 3.6, 3.5.8, or 3.0.18. If you're running Thunderbird, you would appear to have to be on 3.0.2 to be safe. I'm not sure what happened to the 2 branch. Either this vulnerability simply doesn't exist in the 2 branch, in which case you're fine, or you need to go to Thunderbird 3. To be honest, you need to go to Thunderbird 3 for the fantastic new features anyway. But Thunderbird 3.0.2 is where you want to be. And in SeaMonkey, you want to be in 2.0.3 if anyone on this planet actually uses it.
Now, I'm kind of surprised here. You're saying 3.6 for Firefox or 3.5.8. You know, I have mine set to auto-update, and it just did one, like, yesterday, I think, or the day before, and I'm on 3.5.7.
Then you haven't yet got the update from the day after that, I guess.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised.
Being an open-source project, Firefox have a very, what I consider to be the right approach. The minute they find a problem, they patch it. And they don't wait for a Tuesday to come around to push it out. They patch it, they push it out.
Now,
so the window of opportunity to attack Firefox is very short.
But I just
checked.
I just checked, and I asked it for the updates, and it says 3.5.8. It does not say 3.6.
3.6 is the next branch, so it's not going to auto-update you to another branch. So 3.5.8 is one of the safe versions.
Gotcha. Okay. But again, now this is what helps the IT organizations. If you've got this auto-update thing going, this can, this solves your problem. You don't have to know there's updates.
There's no way you have 80% of Firefox users not up to date.
Well,
it just doesn't happen.
Well, yeah, it does. If they aren't to 3.5, once you get them to 3.5, you're okay. But it's not uncommon to find a lot of people below 3.5.
80%?
I
find it very hard to believe it's quite that bad, because Adobe don't make their updates easy either.
Yeah,
I mean, Flash doesn't auto update, for goodness sake.
Right. Okay.
So anyway,
we actually have some big topics, and we've got
we
got to get going.
Let's kick into a dumb question of sorts from Connor, who just felt that this would be a good thing to talk about because it confuses people. So you hear people talking about HTML, XHTML, and HTML5. And HTML5 is this whole big buzzword.
And we're all excited because of the no flash on the iPhone and iPad, and we got to have HTML5. Woohoo! What's HTML5 again?
Yeah, so let's start with a teeny little bit of a history lesson. You probably remember the bad old days where you had Netscape doing their thing and Internet Explorer doing their thing. And so basically you couldn't make one web page and have it display properly everywhere. Now, that's still minorly the case because IE still sucks. But it's much, 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 much less the case than it used to be in the days of the browser wars.
Well, and because Firefox is so much more prevalent now, people have to work to the standards.
Yeah, but a large part of it is also down to the fact that these standards exist. Before the standards existed, you couldn't really blame people for not sticking to them properly because they didn't exist.
Right.
So the W3C, or the World Wide Web Consortium. Yeah.
W3C. Sure. We'll go with that.
World Wide Web Consortium. It's three W's and then a C. So it's called W3C. They're a group, an industry group consisting of stakeholders from all of the involved companies like Internet Explorer, Firefox, Opera, Adobe, all of these companies who give a monkeys about the web, have representatives in the W3C, and through consensus, they create standards that everyone then sticks to, in theory.
Okay.
So the current HTML standard we're using is HTML 4.01, and the shocking thing about HTML 4.01 is its age. It is from 1999.
Really?
Now, in the internet, 1999 is bloody well ancient. I mean, things have changed so much since 1999.
Well, I remember when Kyle was like a freshman in high school and he wanted to learn how to pimp out his MySpace page, and we went to a garage sale and someone had an HTML4 book.
Yeah. That's
so that was like 6 years ago. He got it at a garage sale. So
yeah, that's still our HTML standard. It's now 4.01, but the differences in 4 and 4.01 are minuscule.
Okay. Time to move on.
The other thing in the equation is that HTML looks awfully like XML with all those angled brackets and stuff. But it's actually not valid XML.
Have you explained what XML is to the world yet?
So XML is the extensible markup language, and it's a way to represent any data you'd care to imagine by use of angly brackets.
It's what a podcast feed looks like, and any RSS feed is done in XML.
Yeah. RSS is one XML. RSS is a spec that's in XML, And then there are a million and one other things that are also done in XML. XML is just a great way of getting any information you want encoded in a way that computers can deal with it and shunting it around from A to B. If you have two programs and you want to make them talk to each other, a great way to do it is to create the output of one as XML, slurp it into the other as XML, because both programs can understand XML. There's a million libraries for processing XML. If you use an app like Mars Edit to edit your WordPress blog, it uses XML to send the commands to WordPress using XML RPC or XML Remote Procedure Call. XML is just all over the place in IT, and it's a standardized way of sharing data. Okay. And HTML looks like XML because it has all the angly brackets and things, mm-hmm. but it's not actually valid HTML. So someone said we should really make the few tiny tweaks required to make it valid XML. And so they took HTML4 and turned it into XHTML1.
Okay.
So it is literally just the few tweaks to make HTML be a valid XML. And that's all XHTML is. It's just HTML made XML-y.
Okay.
So it doesn't add any new features. It just makes life easier for techies. But the internet has come a very, very long way since 1999. And we now don't just expect to be able to mark up text and stick in a few images. We kind of expect a little bit more. We expect animations. We expect video. We expect sound. We expect local storage. We expect all sorts of things.
We want 3D. We want it to smell. We want everything.
Yeah. And so that created a big vacuum. So HTML gave us very little of the new cool shiny stuff. And people want the new cool shiny stuff. So that allowed the opportunity for Flash and later Silverlight to become pervasive. Because mm-hmm. HTML just did not provide. People wanted, so Adobe supplied. Poorly, buggily, in a non-standard way, but they supplied.
But they were there.
They were there.
And so a lot of people think that things like Flash are a standard just because it's pervasive, and it's not a standard. It's a proprietary thingy.
Exactly. So it's a standard in the sense that it's there. It's all over the place. So that's sort of a de facto standard, for want of a better term. But it's not actually an open standard. So what that means is that when Adobe does its, or sorry, when Flash does its trick of being a total and utter CPU hog and powerless to do anything about it because they can't re-implement the standard in a sane and, you know, working manner, they have to use Adobe's implementation because Adobe own Flash. So the best they can do is ask really, really nicely. But A, Steve Jobs doesn't ask really, really nicely. And even if he did, I don't think it'd achieve anything.
Right.
So HTML5 is what everyone hopes is going to address this. The next evolution of the HTML standard, and because it will be a public standard, everyone gets to implement it themselves. So if Safari does a buggy implementation of HTML5, Firefox can make a good implementation of HTML5. IE can make a good implementation of HTML5. Every browser manufacturer is free to make the best possible implementation of this open standard, and they're not dependent on any other company. They're not encumbered by licensing and any of that kind of stuff. It's an open standard. They're free to implement as they see fit.
So have they not implemented that yet?
It's a great big bureaucracy, the good old W3C, and it sort of lumbers along at the glacial pace you expect from great big bureaucracy.
So it's not a ratified standard or anything yet?
No.
Are we in, like, when 802.11n wasn't standardized for ratified
for ages? Yeah, that was with the IEEE, which is a different bureaucracy which goes at glacial speeds, but very similar. Yes. But that hasn't stopped a lot of work on the important parts of HTML5. So HTML5 is really taking shape. It just hasn't been formalized, and some of the big things in HTML5 are, there's a tag called video, where you would simply say open angle bracket video, close angle bracket, some URL, and then close the tag. I mean, literally that trivial. I want a video here. And you just simple tag, and in comes the video. Hmm. Similar for audio, that will allow you then to simply embed an audio player with a single tag, just as audio, drop in the details. The canvas tag is another particularly cool one, because it will allow scalable vector graphics, which means you can actually have vector animations in a standard HTML page, without any need for any plugin whatsoever.
Wait. So vector animations. So
yes.
That would replace
Flash.
Right. So there's two different things Flash is used for. Flash is used for delivering video, and mm-hmm. HTML5 solves that, so we don't have to mm-hmm. have Flash. We can get rid of Flash for that. But mm-hmm. then the things like interactive games,
That's 2D graphics. And so all those silly games where you use a... where you have like a penguin that flies off a slide and you beat it over the head.
Exactly, the penguin.
So it's fire. Yeah, those
yeah,
games.
Yeah, yeah.
All those things.
That's what I need.
Two-dimensional graphics.
Yeah.
Clearly that's what we need.
And in that case, you actually can do that with HTML5 also.
Yes, it's through the canvas tag. Now, there was some controversy this week because people leaked that Adobe were holding back the canvas tag. And Adobe said, no, we're absolutely not. And we don't really know what's happening behind the scenes there in the W3C politics. But there was some controversy over the canvas tag this week. Hmm. And Adobe obviously have a vested interest in having canvas fail.
Right.
But they say they're not holding it back, so we have to take them at their word.
And they're part of this same consortium?
They're all, all the stakeholders in the web are part of the W3C. And the standard will only become the standard when everyone agrees it's ready.
Okay.
So there's a lot of politics being played. But it's
Which
kind
is
of
always a good time.
Be too explicit in the politics, or they'll just look bad and be browbeaten into not being so politicky. So anyway, it's slow, glacial. Another big thing is local storage, where basically apps can save data for offline so that you can use web-based tools like, say, Google's Office Suite when you're not connected to the internet.
You're saying that HTML5 will help you do that?
Yeah, it allows offline storage.
So you won't need Google Gears then?
Google Gears is being replaced by HTML5, yeah.
Cool.
And YouTube have also started a pilot project to use the video tag, because there's actually browsers that already support parts of HTML5, including Safari and Firefox.
Oh.
Actually, I should also mention another nice thing. So you have the local storage, the 2D graphics, the video, the audio. Another nice thing is that forum validation is going to become part of the standard. So you can create a web forum and say, this is to be an email address. And then the browser will verify that, you know, will only allow an email address to be entered.
Oh, wow.
Rather than having to look after all that kind of stuff with JavaScript yourself.
So it'll know that it has to be something, @@something.something. Yeah. Oh,
or,
wow.
You know, it's basically specific data types for format elements. So you can say, this has to be a phone number, this has to be an email address, this has to be a number, this has to be a dollar amount, and that kind of thing. So that's all important stuff for the modern internet, but all stuff that we now have to do manually each and every single solitary web page. We do through JavaScript on the front end and through whatever we use in the back end, then it's all a pain in the backside.
So if I personally care a great deal about this. I'm just find it comical that so many people are upset that there's no Flash on the iPad, since I've pretty much never had an experience with Flash that made me actually really happy.
and many to make you very sad.
Oh, yeah. I mean, amongst them, you remember when I was having all the problems with my entire system freezing up during the Ustream live stream, and you said, well, what if it's Flash itself? And I just said, I didn't disagree that that was a possibility, but I didn't know what to do if it was. I mean, what do I do about that? I mean, because that's how Ustream works. I have to use Flash. And right after that, after I did 937 other experiments to try to eliminate possibilities, none of which succeeded, I checked and there was a new version of Flash. And since I've updated that, knock on wood, 4 weeks in a row, I have not frozen. So yeah. I believe Flash was freezing my entire computer.
Yes.
So yeah, Steve Jobs on this one. I'm sorry. It's crapola.
Exactly. And it's kind of a chicken and egg, because developers actually are not loyal to technology. Developers really aren't these ideologues. Developers will develop in whatever they know people can use. So at the moment, developers love Flash because Flash is everywhere. Flash isn't everywhere because developers love Flash. It's exactly the other way around.
Right.
And people kind of install Flash because there's lots of stuff written in Flash. So it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy almost. And you need to break that cycle, and that's what Apple are doing. They're saying, right, none of our products support this junk. So the assumption that everyone has Flash becomes null and void. Which means developers then start to do a Flash version and an HTML5 version. But the HTML5 version is going to become available to use on lots more browsers as HTML5 becomes more adopted. So then why do you need to bother with the Flash version? Why not just give Safari on the desktop the HTML5 experience as well? Why not give Firefox HTML5 experience?
That's going to be so fun.
It really is, but the problem is the HTML5 spec has to get out of committee. Which is why we had so much controversy when the rumor was that Adobe were holding up HTML5.
Right. Well, but, wouldn't they?
Exactly. Well, they don't want to be seen to be, but they still, you know, it's in their interest too, so the more people trying to spotlight on the proceedings of the W3C, the more quickly it'll move, because everyone will be embarrassed to hold it up.
Hmm.
So it's at the moment, what Apple have done is shone a giant big spotlight on the W3C to get HTML5 out the door.
Oh, good. So, I mean, do you think we're in the, you know, within a year? Are we within a decade?
In one sense, we're here already because the iPhone does HTML5. They may have to tweak their implementation when the final spec comes out, but they do it right now. So the video tag is already working on the iPhone. So there's a lot of sites that use Flash for video and the iPhone still works and people scratch their heads. How's that possible? The answer is they're using the video tag in HTML5.
I guess it'll be really interesting to see if the New York Times first implementation is HTML5 instead of Flash.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, there was a particularly poor stunt done by Adobe where they went, you know, oh, the web really does need Flash, and they took screenshots of websites of how they would look on the iPhone if you didn't have Flash, and there was all these blue boxes, also the blue Lego bricks. And then someone went to the actual websites with an actual iPhone, and all but two of these sites had fully working HTML5 implementations.
Oh, so if you went there expecting Flash, you would get Flash. But if you went there without Flash capability, it wouldn't. Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah, so what they had done is they'd use their desktop and to be turned off Flash instead of actually browsing with the iPhone browser, which would render the proper HTML5 and everything would be fine. So anyway, it's here, but it's exactly like the N wireless. It's here, but it isn't.
Where we're just going to ignore the fact that it's not a standard and move on.
Yeah, and expect there to have to be changes. So, I mean, Apple are leading out here by implementing this in Safari before it's an official standard, and they know very well they may have to rewrite some of their code, but they don't really care because at least they're getting stuff done.
And that shouldn't be as big a deal as with hardware. I mean, most people are not going to go do a firmware update to their router, most normal humans. But if it's just an update to a browser, it's like, oh, yeah, whatever, I get those all the time.
Exactly. So it's actually much easier than the N-router thing.
Cool. All right. Well, I hope that answered Connor's question, and I bet a lot of people's, and you know, secretly mine. I had no idea what these people were yapping about. But it's time we get on to our last and big topic. Okay, we're going to do one of those time warp things. I have yet to record it, but I've already written what I'm going to say about Aperture 3. But when people are listening, they've already heard what I think of Aperture 3.
head hurts.
It was a bit problematic for me, to say the least, but I actually don't think I can blame Apple for it, because it was a Finder issue. It wasn't part of Aperture 3. Oh, but wait a minute.
Don't you mean you can't blame Aperture, but you can blame Apple?
Yeah, you're right. They're all Apple. No matter what, it was Apple's fault that I had such a bad problem. I suppose it was my fault for not thinking of reformatting that external drive, which we will. But I wanted to hear how well it went for you, because I know you were really excited about it, and hopefully it went better for you than for me.
Well, let us just say that as of this moment in time, there is no copy of Aperture 3 on any of my machines, and there is a fully running copy of Aperture 2 again.
Ooh, and you did buy Aperture 3, as I recall.
I did buy it. I did install it. I did try to use it.
And how'd that work out for you there, Bart?
Horrifically. So everyone knows about there's a bunch of known issues that seem to be affecting absolutely everyone. There is a memory leak. The longer you leave the app running, the slower it gets. And that's everyone's having that problem, regardless of their hardware. Everyone's having that problem.
And you might not even notice it because it's going to come to a crawl anyway, because it starts doing faces on your 90,000 photo library.
Yeah. So I should probably say that what I did was I did the upgrade, and my library's big, so my upgrade took a long time. And I just let it run overnight. And then the next day I turned on Aperture 3. And I immediately went through the activity monitor, which if you go, it's window and then activity, shows you the activity monitor. It actually lets you see what's going on under the hood within Aperture. That's been there in Aperture 2. It was always a nice little tip. I could see that it was still generating thumbnails and still scanning for faces. So I didn't even try to use it until it was finished those two tasks.
Oh, wow.
Which took overnight. Another night.
I never let it finish.
I did. Because I figured I had heard of so many people having horrible experiences. And in my mind, I was going, it's probably because they're not letting it finish all these kind of background tasks that are really quite intensive on the CPU. It really was. Actually, my CPU was just maxed out for basically two nights in a row. So I let it all finish, and I didn't try to stress it. And I thought to myself, I'm being very smart here, and I'm going to sidestep all of those terrible problems other people have been having.
You're so smart, Bart.
I'm so smart, me backside. So on the third day, I fired it up.
It shouldn't start with that sentence, but
it probably shouldn't. Because it really didn't rise again. It fell flat on its face. So on the third day, I fired it up and I actually tried to do some work.
Okay.
And first thing I did, I had a photograph and it actually needed a local adjustment. So I said, brushes! Haha, I love brushes. I do. The feature's fantastic. So I clicked on the brush, chose my size. I took one stroke and it worked. So I made a second stroke. And rather than it continuing to do what it should have been doing, it corrupted my screen completely and I got digital noise covering the photograph.
Ah! Undo?
Like really bad digital noise covering the entire photograph. I just couldn't see through the digital noise anymore.
Undo?
It was in sort of big blocks. It was really horrible. So I hit sort of undo and my photograph came back. It's like, okay, that's something. At least it came back. So I went, okay, fine, I'll leave alone the local adjustments. I'll try change the white balance. So I picked up the slider, dragged it a couple of clicks, and the whole screen went blue.
Ooh.
The entire photograph became solid blue. Okay. All right, I guess I won't do that adjustment. Fine. I scanned through some more photographs. I was like, these pictures don't look right. They seem to be horribly over-sharpened. I know, I'll hit the loop tool and have a closer look. So I hit the loop tool, and the photograph actually comes up out of focus, as if I had thrown the lens out of focus.
The entire photograph, not just where the loop is?
No, just the loop bit. So it looked like the image was massively horrendously out of focus. And I was like, nah. And then I waited about 20 seconds, and then it became sharp. Okay. I guess it's slow to load images.
You have a lot of extra time, don't you?
Yeah. Well, I was fuming steam out of the ears at this stage.
Yeah.
So I dragged the loop over to actually look at the bit of the photograph I was interested in. And as soon as I touched it to move it, it did the same again. It took 30 seconds before it actually gave me a proper rendering.
We don't need to rush these things, Bart.
Then I started to notice that even simple adjustments that did work, that managed, on the occasions when the adjustment didn't corrupt the whole screen, it was painfully, unusably slow. You just could not physically edit photographs this way.
Now, what's your activity monitor say at that point?
To be honest, activity monitor wasn't all that busy. It just wasn't...
wasn't doing anything, huh?
It just really wasn't working. And when I think about all the things that are giving me trouble, it all comes down to the graphics card. So I've been venting on Twitter and in other places, and the consensus seems to be that certain graphics cards do not get on with Aperture. And Aperture is immensely GPU heavy, much more than CPU heavy. Aperture offloads the donkey work to your GPU. And it just seems that their implementation is hitting into, well, it's buggy on some GPUs. It's just as simple as that. It just does not work on some GPUs. So it actually would seem to be the case that I have one of the bogey GPUs in question.
So there isn't really anything you can do about that.
I have to wait for Apple to fix it. Now, Apple apparently know about the problem, but great. Apple being the wonderfully open company they are, I have no idea whether I had to wait an hour, a day, a week, a month, or a year. I mean, really, you just have no idea.
Have they acknowledged the problem?
Apparently they have. Some people on the Apple forums were saying that they had rang Apple support and were on the phone to them for half an hour. And they were very helpful and they took everything on board and they said that they knew about the problems. So apparently they do know about it. But that there's no statement saying we'll have an update out next week. So I thought about it. At this stage, it was like 2 a.m. and I said, I'm going to bed. I can't deal with this. And I thought about it all day and I said, what am I going to do? I have a shoot coming up. There's a special historical train coming through here tomorrow. I really am. I have plans made. I'm going to be there taking pictures. I need to be able to edit photographs. And I need access to my library. I can't be without it. And I just basically had an unusable setup. So I said, okay, there's only one thing I can do. I need to delete Aperture 3 and install Aperture 2 again. That turned out to be difficult.
Yeah, I don't even know how I would start doing that.
Well, I asked them, I actually started a thread on the Apple forum saying, downgrading from Aperture 2 to Aperture 3, how? I think that was the title I used. So everyone said, oh yeah, look, it's very straightforward. You just drag Aperture 3 into the trash can, drag the library into the trash can, drag the folder and application support into the trash can, and drag the plist in library/preferences into the trash can. Seemed reasonable. That's the normal procedure for getting rid of anything, actually.
Would one make sure one had a backup before one did that? Library?
One should also have made up one had a full backup before one touched Aperture 3, which I also did.
I was smart. I had three backups.
I always have.
And I used up two of them, so that was a good thing.
Exactly. See? Can never have enough backups. So I trashed it. They emptied the trash can, and I thought Aperture was gone. So I stuck in the DVD for Aperture 2, went to the installer, I clicked the customize button because I did not want those 7 gigs of demos.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I got to get rid of those. I think those are still in mine.
Yeah.
Remind me later where those are.
They're in the library application support Aperture, I think. Not library in your account, but the root library, if memory serves.
Oh, really?
I had to find them before and nuke them. They're in the root library.
Oh, my gosh.
So, I stuck in the DVD, clicked the customize, and noticed that Aperture 2 was grayed out. The Aperture installer knew that Aperture 3 had been installed and was like, I'm not letting... You know the way if you
and
go
you've
to
thrown
install
it away
iTunes,
at this point?
Yeah, I think I thought I had.
Oh, wow.
You know the way if you install iLife, the iTunes option is almost always grayed out because it knows you have iTunes 9 and the DVD has iTunes 8 or something, and it refuses to replace a good version with a bad version, which is a realistic thing to do. But I was pretty sure I trashed everything. Turns out that I found out afterwards. I solved the problem by going to Time Machine, and rather than letting it reinstall itself, I just restored from Time Machine the three things I trashed.
Oh.
Four things I trashed.
Oh, that's an interesting idea.
So I restored my library, I restored my app, I restored the P list, and I restored the folder in application support. And that was it. It worked.
Oh,
I found out afterwards what the actual solution would have been to get it to install from the installer. There's a folder in your root library called package receipts or something like that, which basically stores a list of every PKG installer you've used. So it's like a register of the software that's been installed, and there's a receipt for installing Aperture 3. So Aperture 2 looks at the receipts and sees Aperture 3 and goes, oh, can't go on here. There's Aperture 3 here. So if I'd found the receipt and deleted the receipt, I wouldn't have had that problem.
Oh, that's... I'm sorry. That's sort of a past a high intermediate level skill to find that, I would think.
Yes, you know, it really is. And it's possible, had I had a copy of AppZapper or AppDelete, it possibly would have found that receipt if I had deleted it that way. Oh, so that's also a possibility. I don't know that for sure.
Another plug for my buddy that does AppDelete. That would be interesting. I'm almost tempted to try that to find out. No, I know it. I'll make Reggie do that himself.
I was just going to say, email Reggie, and I'm sure he'll be very quick to get back to you.
Yeah.
But this brings another point up, which is that Apple are arrogant enough not to create uninstallers. We don't tolerate that on Windows. We really don't. And it's become the case that even the crappiest, poorest piece of Windows software comes with an uninstaller.
Yeah.
The add remove programs suck it out.
Yeah, I don't know that they do a perfect job, though. They leave crap in the registry.
They may not do a perfect job, but at least they have a way of getting it out.
They're trying.
Apple don't even provide a flawed means. They just arrogantly assume that you would never, ever want to delete their software.
Right, right. You'd rather a flawed means. I like that.
Yeah, it's something. I mean, then we could complain about their incompetence, but not their arrogance.
That's good. You'd like to narrow it down.
Yeah, so anyway, long story short, it was utterly unusable, and after much struggling and another day's worth of swearing, I am now back on Aperture 2, and everything's absolutely fine, except I've lost a week of productivity.
And $100.
Right back where I started.
And $100.
Oh, no, okay. The feature set is fantastic, and I know that when they deal with these bugs, I'm going to want Aperture 3. I don't see it as being wasted. I just bought too soon.
Just delayed.
Should have kept the money in my account and got the interest.
But on the other hand, this is who we are, right? This is what we do.
Yeah.
This is the sport of it. And we're doing it for the next guy who's listening right now who goes, woo, I think I'll collect the interest until Bart and Allison say this one's working.
Do you know something? I got so many at tweets this week from people saying, thanks so much for sharing your experience. Yeah. I'm going to wait.
I hope they get on this quickly. I mean, it's so bad they have to, right? I mean, this isn't just a little annoying. This is unusable for you.
And this is a pro app.
Yeah, good point. Good point. They can't be pissing off the pro people. I mean, look at
somebody. Well, they are, but they really shouldn't. Right. They should minimize that.
We look at Victor Cahiao, who's been a Lightroom guy for a long time. And looking at Lightroom and Aperture, it's sort of like saying Canon versus Nikon. You know, you start on one path and you love it and you think the other one's stupid, but I think they're probably.
And you get lucky. Yeah. Instead of having lenses lock you in as libraries.
Yeah. I mean, there are ways to switch. There's ways to export and import and that sort of thing. But it's you know, I say tomato, you say tomato kind of a problem. It's not a big difference. But so Victor finally said, wow, you know, that Aperture 3 is starting to look really good. I think I'll try the demo. He ran screaming from it back to Lightroom. And it'll probably be a long time before he gives him another shot at it.
And on the typical Shutterbugs forums, everyone's saying, and this is why I use Lightroom. And I told you so. Come over to the light and then in brackets room side. Yeah, exactly. So really, this is shooting themselves in the foot big time here. And I'm not always in agreement with a certain Mr. Scott Bourne, but he points out quite astutely that if Apple had a beta process, this kind of rubbish wouldn't happen.
Oh, that's a good point.
But instead, they're completely and totally secretive, and then they spring a supposedly final product on us, which turns out to be a poor beta at best.
Thanks for your help, Apple.
Yeah. And the other thing, which I haven't hit because I don't even have a 64-bit machine, so I'm stuck on the 32-bit mode, but Aperture is now a 64-bit app, but all the plugins are now 32-bit apps. So every time you try to use a plugin, you get that same problem you have in the control panel, in the preference panes. When you load a 32-bit preference pane, it has to quit and relaunch. Now, Aperture is a fairly chunky app to be quitting and relaunching.
Yeah.
So again, the developers had no idea they should have been compiling 64-bit versions of their plugins because they didn't know it was coming. So they couldn't possibly prepare.
Thanks
because
for your
there
help.
Was no beta.
Right. So, well, I hope we maybe even by next week or something, there's something some better news on this. But I mean, you're going to have to set aside another week to do this, right? Well, I mean, at the very least,
I know
the
it's
3 days.
Day upgrade. Right. It's a 2-day upgrade.
You know, people mocked me for doing it on the road, but it was actually quite convenient for me because there were long periods of time where I wasn't using my Mac. I mean, I'd start up my Mac to start doing the Aperture 2 to Aperture 3 upgrade to my library, and then I'd go to a party at home. I'm not willing to do that, you know, because I'm sitting on my couch playing with my Mac.
That is very true. I mean, I have the old iMac to keep me entertained, but my MacBook Pro is entertaining itself by upgrading Aperture. So I guess I can survive. But yeah, it's much better to go to a party than to sit there watching a very, very slow progress bar.
Right. All right. Well, I think that's going to probably wind it up. We've been going on a long time here, but that was an interesting segment, I think.
Okay. Well, I presume it's business as usual next week.
I believe so. I don't know of anything in my way.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything interesting happening in my life. No danger of that. So.
Oh, come on. This is interesting.
Yeah, I suppose, in a way. I mean, you live in interesting times, kind of interesting.
There you go.
Anyway, until next time, happy computing.
Well, after I got off the horn with Bart, I shot a note over to Reggie Ashworth, the creator of AppDelete, at reggieashworth.com, to ask him if his application would have cleaned things out for Bart so that his downgrade install of Aperture 3 would have gone more smoothly. Here's what he wrote back. To answer your question, yes, AppDelete would have taken care of the plist files and the package receipts. Usually with Apple apps, it's a package receipt that stops a downgrade. Sometimes deleting package receipts can also fix a problem if software update is not locating a certain update. But I haven't experienced that problem personally since probably Tiger. But again, yes, AppDelete will clean those out for you. Well, I learned something here. I didn't know about those package receipts until Bart mentioned them. And I learned another reason that AppDelete is an essential tool to have on your Mac. I know this sounds like a commercial, but I'm sure Bart would have shelled out the giant cost of $8 for AppDelete to save himself all that grief for now and in the future. On that note, I think it's time to draw the show to a close. Would you believe I actually cut stuff out of this show? If you'd like to contribute, ask a dumb question, send letters of praise for the show, send complaints. Anyway, send your thoughts along to Allison@podfeet.com and be sure to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.